MechCast, Thursday, September 18th, 2014. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, today's show is an exciting show for a lot of reasons. There is a lot going on. One, this is show 500, and I probably should be doing a lot more for show 500. We should have had some sort of event fanfare, I guess. We get show 500. Welcome. That's the best I got for you. I've been busy moving, as you know, so things have been a bit crazy. Didn't have any time to plan a big special event. But hey, if you'd like to send in your thoughts, if you've been a listener for a while, I'd appreciate hearing those. It's been fun delivering you 500 episodes, and I'm looking forward to 500 more. So we've got that going on. Second thing that's happening is I'm in MacCast Studios 1.5, and I'm calling it 1.5 because hopefully this is a temporary situation. I posted a picture on Twitter, but I'm in a 6x6x6 cube. I guess Apple would be very proud of me for being in a cube, but 6x6x6 walk-in closet in my new house. Yes, I lost my spare bedroom, which was my studio in my old house. We downsized a little bit, but I'm not complaining. We love it here, and it's a nice place to live. But for at least the next couple months or so, and until I can figure out a new studio situation, I'm going to be in the closet. Yes, let the jokes fly. I'm willing to accept them. But it's not too bad. I've got some padding up here, so hopefully it's not too echoey. If it sounds a little bit different, let me know. I think it actually sounds pretty good. It might even sound a little bit better than the old studio. Don't tell the old studio. But anyway, can you tell I'm in a good mood today? I am in a very good mood. And then the last thing is, tomorrow's iPhone 6 day. Yes, Apple will be selling iPhones at their retail stores. You can get them at your carrier stores. Sounding like you might have some trouble if you try and go into Best Buy or some of the retail partners, though, especially if you want an iPhone 6 Plus. The 6 seems like it's going to be around in some pretty good supplies. Of course, we're going to be talking about that on the show. Also, some of the latest news and information related to all of the iPhone 6 stuff, some new Apple Watch information also in today's show, along with a bunch of great feedback, tips and tricks. Got a lot of comments from all of you about Apple's announcements, the iPhone 6, the Apple Watch. We're going to address some of those. We're going to try and answer some of your questions. All the fun stuff we do on the MacCast each and every week. But before we get to all of that, before we get to the rest of show 500, I want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Sanebox. We all get tons of email. I get tons of email. I know you get tons of email. Your inbox seems like it's out of control, right? Well, that's what Sanebox is for. Sanebox is for you. It's for me. It's for basically filtering and prioritizing your emails, getting the important stuff in front of you, keeping that in your inbox, getting all the rest of that stuff, shuffling it off, putting it out of the way, not deleting it or removing it, but just sort of managing it, putting it in another area so you can come back and review that stuff later. It basically cleans up your inbox and then sends you a email summary and says, hey, this is what we did. We moved these messages over there, these over there, so you can check them out. And they have some kind of default locations that it moves stuff into. One is called the Sane Later box. So those are things that you might want to get to later. Another box is called the Sane Bulk folder. That's where all of like your order receipts and those sorts of things for online purchases can wind up. And you can customize all this stuff. You can set it all up. But the key is you just have your important emails in your inbox. And the way it does it is really smart. It analyzes how you use your mail. So you sign up for Sanebox, you turn it on, and then it just watches your behavior. And it'll set up these default boxes. So if for some reason a order receipt comes into your inbox, you move it into the Sane Bulk folder, it'll recognize that. And the next time an order like that comes in, an email like that comes in, it knows exactly where to put it. If it puts something in the wrong place, maybe it puts one of those important emails into the Sane Later box for some reason, just move it back to your inbox and it'll note that. It'll pay attention to who you're replying to. Now, they're not storing any of this data. They're just using it to build up that profile so they know how to sort out your inbox. And it's amazing. It works like magic. I've been using it and it has saved my life because now your emails show up in my inbox and they're not cluttered and mixed in with all those other emails. It makes it much easier for me to reply. So amazing, amazing stuff. And that's just kind of just the start of it. They have a bunch of other features you can enable and turn on. You can customize it. They have the ability to snooze non-urgent emails. So if something comes in your inbox and say, you know, I need to get to this, but I don't need to get to it for 3 days. You can set up a 3-day box and you drop it in there. And then 3 days later, guess what? Boom, it shows right back up in your inbox. They can do stuff like move all of your attachments to Dropbox, free up storage in your mail, those sorts of things. And they now have a Kindle book. They just put out a Kindle book, How to Outsmart Your Inbox. It's 99 cents on the Kindle store. And if you're a Kindle Unlimited subscriber, you can actually get it for free. So I'll have a link to that in the show notes if you want to check that out. Just basic tips on better inbox management, and just 99 cents. So that's a good deal. As far as Sanebox goes, here's an even better deal. You get a free trial, plus you can get a $10 credit on your Sanebox order by going to sanebox.com/maccast. So go there, check it out, try out Sanebox, try it for free. I know you're going to love it. It will make your inbox sane again. Sanebox, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. Now let's get into the whole iPhone pre-ordering thing. I want to kick off the news with that. It's, you know, basically the same thing we do every year. It's the same old experience. And that's a bit unfortunate because I keep hoping every year that Apple is going to get better at the whole pre-ordering thing. I know I've heard from many of you. A lot of you were online midnight, 2 a.m., 3 a.m., depending upon what part of the world you were in. It may have been an even more insane time or maybe a more sane time. But we all got on there. And the deadline went by, and nothing happened, right? The store wasn't there. No one could get in. Twitter went crazy. People were frustrated, angry, couldn't get your pre-orders in about, and I guess it kind of felt like the keynote, right? It was like the keynote all over again, just the technology completely failing, just slammed as it always is, and you'd think they could prepare for it. Some people were having better luck getting in on the carrier websites, so going directly to the carrier sites. I think AT&T and Verizon and all those guys in the States had it pretty well under control. Actually, AT&T was doing a pretty good system where they would queue you up virtually. So you got there, and it would come up with a page saying, all right, you're in line, but we're not ready to take your order yet. We'll let you know. And you kind of had to hang out. But Apple was just nowhere to be found, especially their website. A lot of people were trying to get in on the app, which historically has been always the better way to pre-order. So make this note for future if you tried and weren't able to get in. Fire up the Apple Store app and you can get in that way. And that's ultimately how I was able to get in, probably about 40 to 50 minutes after the start time. And I got in there. I had to go through sort of testing if I was qualified for upgrade first. And once it verified that, kind of let me in. My mistake was, though, AT&T, the line that I thought was my upgrade-eligible line, wasn't the line that was actually eligible for upgrade. Somehow things got swapped around, probably my fault due to all the years of sort of SIM swapping and downgrading my wife's phone. But by the time I got the order in my cart, it was for an early upgrade price, so much higher cost, about $250 higher than the subsidized price. But I didn't want to back out at that point because I was worried. I wanted to get my iPhone order in. And so I just pressed through, and I'm going to have to take a little bit of a hit. But good news is I'm going to be able to pick up my iPhone up at the store tomorrow. So I'll be able to have my coverage for you. I'll try and do an unboxing video. I don't know if I'll be able to get it out day one like I typically have in the past. But, you know, stay tuned to the MacCast YouTube channel for that. And I will have all my thoughts, first impressions, those sort of things. I'll share those on Twitter, and we'll talk about all of that on the next episode of MacCast. But now, at this point, a lot of you are probably saying, well, Adam, what phone did you get, right? Because we know you didn't get the 6 Plus because you said that there was no way you were going to get a bigger phone. Yeah, I'm probably the world's biggest hypocrite. And I think I'm gonna play this to my defense. You can accept it or not. But I am going to say that I said on several episodes that I had this fear that Apple was going to have some features in the 6 Plus that weren't in the 6. And if they weren't feature equivalent, I might be, and I use the word forced, and that may or may not be true ultimately once I get the phone in my hands and have it for a while, forced to get the larger phone because I don't want to feel like I missed out on features. And some of that happened. It wasn't as extreme as I thought it was going to be, but things like the optical image stabilization, those I want to be able to play around with. I want to test it out. And that's a really nice feature, especially for a guy like me who kind of has shaky hands. But really the thing that put me over the top, and I am still not excited about the screen size. I think I might end up liking it. I'm willing to accept that I might end up liking it. But I know I'm going to be constantly frustrated by the fact that I can't easily carry that phone around in my pocket. And I'm also going to be frustrated by the lack of being able to use it one-handed. And don't talk to me about the whole reachability thing. That's just janky, goofy. Again, I reserve the right to change my opinion once I use it, but just based on what I've seen and some of the comments I've heard from some people who've actually touched it and used it and played with it, I don't see that being really a good solution. I think that was sort of a half-baked solution by Apple. And I think, you know, the honest answer is it's a two-handed device. The 6 Plus is a two-handed device. You're not going to be able to comfortably use that thing one-handed. And I'm going to have to resolve myself to that or maybe return it and get a new one. If I really hate it, I may be taking advantage of my 14-day return policy. But the thing that put me over the top, getting back to that, was the UI enhancements that you can get a two-up view in landscape in mail. I think for productivity for me, that's going to be a big deal. I answer a lot of email, a lot of your emails on my iPhone. So those sorts of things. I like to do reading and take notes. And I kind of, you know, I gave up my iPad mini for an iPad Air. And I think that was absolutely the right choice for me because the Air, again, allows me to get a lot more work done in terms of research and doing notes and things like that because of the larger screen size. And I'm hoping that the 6 Plus is going to offer that same thing for me in the phone where there's going to be those situations where I just want to take one device. Right now, I have my iPhone and my iPad typically, and then very often I'll also have my MacBook Pro with me. But there's times when I'm like, I just want to head out for a little bit, maybe go down to the coffee shop. All I want to do is maybe do some research, take a few notes, but I'll usually take my iPad Air with me because that's the most comfortable thing for me to use. Now I'm thinking with this larger phone, especially with the iPad-like interface, I may be able to get away from time to time with just taking that one device. And so that is ultimately the thing that sort of put me over the top. And then those added benefits of the higher screen resolution or pixel density, I think that's going to look really gorgeous on that display. And then the optical image stabilization. So when you put all that together, yeah, it pushed me over the edge. And again, you can call me a hypocrite. I will admit that that's exactly what. But you know, the other thing that pushed me over the edge is my wife said, you know, you said the same sort of thing about the 5S, that it was going to be too big or it just felt weird. And then 2 weeks later, you were totally fine with it. And, you know, I resolved myself to that, too. So I don't think I'm going to change my strong opinions for the future on these devices. Just know and accept that I'm the type of person who says one thing and may do completely the exact opposite. So some of you may be disappointed. I know others of you are very happy and are going to say, I told you so. And I accept that. That's good. That's fine. And so getting back to the pre-orders, despite all of those roadblocks and bumps in the road and those sorts of things, that did not stop Apple from making record-breaking pre-orders. So people couldn't even get in and they ordered a metric ton load of phones. Recode said the next day that record pre-orders happened overnight, according to Apple. AT&T claimed that demand was higher than both the past two iPhone launches, not together, but for each iPhone launch, the pre-orders exceeded that. And then officially, after about 24 hours, Apple came out and announced that they had taken 4 million pre-orders of iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. Now, Apple never breaks it down, so we don't know how many 6s and 6 Pluses. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that at least for pre-orders, I think the 6 Plus is probably the one that a lot of people are really going for. You know, it's us tech junkies, the guys that have to have the latest and greatest. That was another reason, honestly, why I got the 6 Plus, because I want to have the new thing, the really new thing. And I know that the 6 is, you know, at 4.7 inches is slightly larger. But, you know, there's that cachet of having the newest thing that is different, a lot different. And so that played into my factor, too. And I think that's in the buying decisions of a lot of people, at least at the initial launch, because we're all the early adopters. I think ultimately, given over time, I think the iPhone 6 is going to prove to be the more popular of the models. But I could be proven wrong there, too, because a lot of people really like that larger form factor. But as far as predictions go, as of tomorrow, once they're in retail stores, it's looking like some analysts believe Apple could sell up to 10 million iPhones in the opening weekend. And that's at least according to Maynard Oom. That would be double the iPhone 5 opening weekend. iPhone 5, not 5S. I couldn't find I need to do a little more research and find the iPhone 5S numbers, but double the iPhone 5 numbers, which would be huge, a big record for Apple. Now, the caveat there, and Maynard Oom didn't say this, but some other analysts pointed this out, and I thought this immediately, is that's going to be dependent on how many phones Apple can actually get into the store. Like, do they even have 10 million to sell on launch day? And that remains to be seen. But as far as long-term estimates, a lot of analysts are looking for the September quarter. So that's the quarter ending in September. So just a few, you know, weeks of iPhone sales. Really, they're predicting 35 to 37 million iPhones sold. That's a huge number. And then the following quarter, first full quarter, December, predictions are between 59 and 62 million iPhones. So Tim Cook said this was going to be the biggest iPhone ever. I think no doubt. I think a lot of people are very excited about this phone. Just based on the emails I've been getting and the things I've been seeing and reading, I think a lot of people are happy that Apple's finally delivered these larger sizes. And a lot of people are talking about, you know, will iPad mini sales decline because of the larger screen phones? I think consensus is that probably is going to happen. You know, they're calling it iPad mini cannibalization. I think that may be a bit extreme. I think the iPad mini is still going to be a very popular choice for a lot of people. But I think the key thing to understand is Apple's probably okay with it because the iPhones make more money. There's a higher profit margin, higher selling price, higher margins in the iPhones. So they're actually going to make more money. So they're going to cannibalize themselves, which is what they always do. And that's more than going to offset any loss in sales in iPad mini sales. But as far as, you know, the future, again, those numbers, those big numbers are all going to be dependent upon Apple actually being able to produce phones. And we've been hearing some things that make it sound like they're going to have some trouble doing that. Foxconn is reportedly already having issues in meeting the pre-order demand. They have 100 dedicated assembly lines making 140,000 iPhone 6s or 6 pluses a day, 400,000 iPhone 6s a day, but that may not be enough. They're saying 5.5-inch displays on the iPhone 6 Plus. Those are in short supply, apparently because of Apple's stringent, you know, sort of quality specs for those displays. They're saying 50 to 60% of the displays being manufactured are being rejected. They can't even use them. So that's slowing the iPhone 6 Plus production even more. So just getting those component parts can be an issue. And so we'll have to see if they can churn out enough to meet demand for the end of the year. But it's sounding like at least for a while, iPhones are going to be in short supply for sure. And as a matter of fact, at this point, if you want one, you better be in line early tomorrow. And it's sounding like Apple stores or carrier stores are going to be your best bet if you want an iPhone 6 Plus. The iPhone 6, it looks like, is going to be in pretty good supply in most locations. But I read a report that the iPhone 6 Plus is kind of being reserved for the carrier stores and Apple stores, and that other resellers like Best Buy and those other retail locations, they're getting either very low quantities of the 6 Plus or they're getting no 6 Pluses. So again, all of this is just rumor, but I do have one source at a Best Buy location, and they were able to confirm that they did not get any iPhone 6 Pluses, at least as of the recording of this podcast. I guess there's always a chance a shipment could come in, but again, that's just one Best Buy location, and so take that with a grain of salt, but that's what I've heard so far. So I would say get in line at an Apple retail store or a carrier store if you're looking for a 6 Plus. But again, 6s should be all right. The new phones have started shipping, and supposedly some people got their shipments early, at least in China and Vietnam. Now, we're going to talk about the China thing in a bit because I'm not buying that one, and I'll tell you the reason why. But as far as other locations, carriers have received iPhone shipments, but they've been told to hold actual delivery until Friday, and that seems to be happening at least in the States and in Europe and Australia, those sorts of places. You Australians are going to have it probably by the time you hear this podcast, because you guys are ahead of us. But send in your comments. Let me know what you think. I want to see some pictures from those of you who are getting it in the future for me. You know, you're in the future from me because you're getting it almost a day early. But anyway, let's talk about those ones that have shown up in China and Vietnam early. The China one, I think, has to have been either taken from a factory or pulled off a truck, or I don't know, because Apple doesn't have the regulatory approvals they need yet to actually be selling iPhones in China. So they were supposed to go on sale, I think, in China on September 26th, on that September 26th date, but it's sounding like they're not going to actually come out in China until maybe 2015. They only got one approval. They still need one more. The one in Vietnam could be legit, although who knows? The unboxing of it, though, definitely shows that the iPhone 6 Plus is huge. And the packaging this year is really interesting, too. It's very minimalistic. They actually have an image of this on Apple's website. The phone on the top is almost, I don't know if it's an embossed or it's just white outline of an iPhone. It just says iPhone on the box and it's all white. So very, it looks like almost the reverse of an Apple commercial. If you took the box that they put those people in on those Apple promo videos and turn it inside out, that's your iPhone 6 Plus or 6 and 6 Plus box. So I'll be showing that off too in my unboxing video and we'll talk about that a little bit more. But I don't know about you. I'm very excited. Can't wait to get this thing in my hands and start playing around with it. And when you do, we're finding out some more information about some of the enhancements and things that weren't talked about in the keynote. Specifically, it looks like there's a new video codec support in the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. It's going to support H.265 encoding and decoding, which is, I guess, the next step up from H.264. It's also known as high-efficiency video coding, and the deal is you get the same quality video but at half the bit rate, so it's much more efficient in terms of transmitting the video. And apparently that means that the iPhone 6 will allow FaceTime calls over cellular with about half the data consumption. So when you're doing your FaceTime and video calls over the cellular data networks, you're going to be using up a lot less of your bandwidth, which is always a good thing. And the speculation is that it's in the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus because there may be a dedicated module on there, maybe inside the A8 processor for encoding and decoding the new H.265 codec. So we got that there. There's also been some more speculation on what the specs of the A8 processor might be. This is based on Apple's marketing claims for performance. Anantech took a look at that and believes that the A8 could have a 6-core PowerVR series 6XT GX6650 GPU. That's a mouthful, but basically next generation PowerVR GPU. And the reason that they think that is they looked at the specs and where they were, and it's the only chip that seems to be able to support the speed claims that Apple is touting, and also carries what's called ARM's adaptive scalable texture compression, and that is referenced as being available in developer documentation. So we know it has that functionality in there, so they matched that with the speed claims and came up with, well, this must be the GPU. So that would be a bump up. I think we were currently at a 4-core GPU, so moving to a 6-core would definitely help with performance. They also speculate that the A8 CPU is clocked at 1.4 gigahertz. Now, early reports said it might be at 2 gigahertz, because really 1.4, that's only 100 megahertz higher than the A7, which is clocked at 1.3. So I found that spec to be interesting, but it looks like, you know, maybe the iPhone's leaning much more heavily on the GPU than the CPU. And also, it's looking like we're going to get just 1 gigabyte of RAM in both the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus. Most believe that's what's in there. We're going to have to wait until they're actually in the hands of a site, say, like iFixit, before we know absolutely for sure. But speculation as to why Apple didn't bump up the RAM in either of the models is probably to keep that battery life high. I guess they could have gone 2 gigabytes in the iPhone 6 Plus, but then maybe we wouldn't have that phenomenal battery life that's in there. Oh, and that was another reason. I forgot that as a reason I decided to go with the 6 Plus. You know, again, I use my phone a lot. I depend on it for conferences like Macworld, and the idea of maybe not having to be not having to carry around a charger or plug it in midday or late in the day at those events is appealing to me as well. So willing to sacrifice some convenience in terms of size for some of those additional features. Another bonus for those of you getting an iPhone 6 or 6 Plus, it's looking like iWork and iLife are going to be pre-installed on the 64 gigabyte and 128 gigabyte model, so you won't have to download those after the fact. If you don't want them, of course, you can remove them, but you're going to get iMovie, GarageBand, Keynote, Pages, Numbers, and iTunes U. The 16 gigabyte models are not going to have them pre-installed, but of course, you can manually download them from the App Store if you want, because they do come with new phones. So I guess they figure the 16 gigabyte model just doesn't have enough extra free space to warrant sort of preloading that stuff. The NFC chip in the new iPhone, if you were a developer or you were hoping that your favorite app was going to be able to take advantage of that, sounds like they're not going to be able to do that, at least not right off the bat. According to Cult of Mac, they confirmed this with Apple. The NFC chip in the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus is only for Apple Pay. So you'll only be able to use it for Apple Pay, at least for now. You know, we've had this sort of situation in the past where Apple's rolled out a new feature, held it reserved. Touch ID is a good example, just for Apple, and then later made it available to developers and to third-party apps. So I hope at some point they do open that up, because there might be some very interesting things that third-party developers could do with NFC, and especially for places where you maybe have NFC for, say, rail systems in certain countries, to be able to have an app that would be able to take advantage of that so you can pay for your rail travel with your phone. That would be awesome. And then finally, I didn't know this, both iPhones are going to get the sort of extra keys on the side of the keyboard. It sounds like the 6 Plus is going to get a few more, but even the 6 is going to have a few extra keys. Most importantly, it sounds like the arrow keys, and this is according to a review from John Gruber, and he gave a couple really cool tips with those arrow keys. So the arrow keys are obviously so you can move the cursor around as you're typing, but if you engage the cap locks, the arrow keys will actually expand and shrink your text selections. So there's a cool little tip for you that you can try out when you get your new iPhone 6 tomorrow. And, of course, iPhone 6 is launching in limited countries, but Apple is trying to have their most aggressive rollout ever. They're saying they're trying to reach 115 countries by the end of the year. And it looks like the next set of countries are going to be Austria, Belgium, Denmark, Finland, Ireland, Italy, Luxembourg, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Portugal, Taiwan, Turkey, Russia, Spain, Sweden, and Switzerland. They are reportedly getting the iPhone 6 on September 26th. And United Arab Emirates is also getting it. I read a day later on the 27th, but I think I also saw that they may also be launching on the 26th there. And U.S. regional carriers are going to get the iPhone on the 26th as well. So if you're in any of those countries, you don't have much longer to wait. And India was actually originally slated to get the iPhone on September 26th also, but they keep getting pushed back. I'm not really sure the reason why. It slipped to October and then reportedly was pushed back now to mid-November. So if you're in India, you're going to be waiting quite a bit longer. And the bummer of that is that China's delayed till 2015. India's delayed till, much later in the year, and those are two of Apple's largest and fastest growing markets. So that's a lot of sales that Apple is potentially missing out on, at least initially. But I would expect launches in those countries to be huge as well, no matter when Apple can actually get the iPhone 6 delivered there. But that's sort of all the latest on the iPhone 6, and of course we're going to have a lot more in future episodes, more hands-on actual stuff with the iPhone 6 after tomorrow, so stay tuned. In anticipation of the iPhone 6 launch, though, Apple did release iOS 8 on the 17th, as they said during the keynote, and I have some cool tips and tricks there for you, a little bit of details on some of the latest and greatest stuff, as well as a little bit of a warning. So let's do the warning up front, and that is iCloud Drive. You likely do not want to upgrade to iCloud Drive, which is a big part of iOS 8. Apple is switching their documents in the cloud service on iCloud over to iCloud Drive. And iCloud Drive is more exciting because it's a lot more Dropbox-like. It's going to have integration with OS X Yosemite. You'll be able to browse your content from different apps, more like folders right in the Finder. And that's all really cool. The problem is that it requires running OS X Yosemite, which, unless you're in the public beta program, you probably don't have. So iCloud, if you enable it, it will move all of your stuff over into iCloud Drive. But if you're not on Yosemite, you're not going to have access on your desktop Mac. And it actually pops up and warns you about that. But I think a lot of people aren't going to read and just click OK. And here's the bummer. iCloud Drive is a one-way street. Once your documents have been moved and you're doing things a new way, you cannot go back. You cannot get back to those documents. So you'd be forced waiting till OS X Yosemite comes out. And we don't even have a release date for Yosemite yet. Probably sometime in October is what it's looking like it's going to be. But we don't know the actual date. So who knows how long you'll be waiting. So don't you probably don't want to enable iCloud Drive. And you can continue to do things the old way and then just switch over later. You don't have to switch over when you upgrade to iOS 8. So just watch out for that one. The other thing you probably want to think about is, are you ready to upgrade to iOS 8? Be sure to check out the specs on Apple's website, but basically it will do anything from an iPhone 4S or better, iPad 2 or better, and also only the latest iPod Touch. So you have to have the fifth generation iPod Touch. But here's the deal. On the 4S and the iPad 2, early reviews are saying it's actually kind of a dog. It's pretty slow. So I would hesitate if I had an iPhone 4S or an iPad 2 in upgrading to iOS 8. You know, talk to maybe other people, watch for reviews, read some of the reviews online and see how the experience is before you just, you know, jump right in and upgrade on those models. But I think everything else should be okay. I've also heard the iPad mini non-Retina is a little bit slow as well. So that may be another one to take caution with. But if you are going to upgrade, one, make sure that you've done a backup of your device before you upgrade. You could use iCloud backup, or just make sure you connect to iTunes first, let it do a fresh backup of all of your stuff. Also, you may want to transfer any purchase content into iTunes. So, you know, go into the store menu and check for purchasers or transfer purchases and do that prior to backing up. So do that, then back up your device. And then you can either do the upgrade over the air, right? You can go into settings, general, and just check for updates, do it over the air right on your device, or connect it up through iTunes and do it there. And if you try over the air and you find that you don't have enough space to do the upgrade, because you actually have to download it to the device, you have to have enough space to download the installer to the device and then run the installer. If you're tight on space, that doesn't work for you. Try upgrading through iTunes, because then it can download to your computer and then install. So that can help out. Otherwise, you're probably going to have to clear off some space if neither of those methods work. So, you know, go through and make sure you've removed any videos is usually the biggest one. I usually go into my movies and see what I've synced over and just unsync your movies while you do the upgrade, and you should be good to go. But once you have it installed, you know, what are the things to check out? What are some of the first kind of newest, coolest features that you might want to take a look at? Real-time exposure in the camera app. So now you can do your selective focus by tapping, but also adjust where it's doing the exposure control. In the past, wherever you tapped was also where it did the exposure from. Now you can actually tap, and when you tap, you'll get a little slider, and you can slide your finger up and down to adjust the exposure manually. If you just tap, it is going to do the auto exposure thing, just like before, in whatever area you tapped in to focus. But then you can also manually adjust it before you take the picture. And you see it adjust in real time on the screen, which is pretty cool. Third-party keyboards, a lot of people very excited about that. Finally, we're able to get beyond Apple's default keyboard. I've always been happy with Apple's keyboard. And actually, the new QuickType feature is pretty neat. So in Apple's own keyboard, they now have something called QuickType. So as you type, suggested words will come up at the top, three words of the word that you might be trying to type. And it actually will start to learn how you type, and more specifically, how you type to different types of people. So if you're responding an email to different people, business emails will come up with different words than, say, your personal emails. And it actually works pretty well. It's interesting, too, just to see some of the funky things it comes up with, but I'm assuming it'll get better over time. And what you can just do is tap to accept any one of the words that's already up there. So you start typing, you see the word, oh, that's the word I want. You just tap that. It'll type it out for you, and then you can go on to the next word. And sometimes I found you can even just stick to the QuickType keyboard. It'll have the next word already being the word that you wanted to type. So it does get a little bit quicker. It takes a bit of getting used to. It's not fast right out of the gate, but you can do that. And if you don't like it, you can just swipe down on the QuickType area, and it will hide it. If you want to bring it back, just swipe back up in that area. But if you don't like that, we've got third-party keyboards. So Swipe, SwiftKey, Flesky, also Text Expander, all have custom keyboards now, and you won't see them by default. You need to have the app installed, so the Swipe app, the Flesky app, or the, you know, Text Expander app. And then once you have it installed, you do need to install the keyboard. So you'll need to go into Settings, General, Keyboard, and then click on the Add Keyboard option. And then you'll see the third-party keyboards listed right there. You just tap the one you want. You can control the order of them by sliding them up and down in the list, and then they will be activated. And note that some of the keyboards require additional access, and you have to allow that. So, for example, with the Text Expander keyboard, you do need to, once you've added it, then tap on it in the settings to get to the secondary screen and then allow it to have access to the system to be able to do what it needs to do. And just so make note of that as you're adding your third-party keyboards. But once you have them in there, then you just tap on the little globe to toggle through them. Or I also learned from Jeff Gamet's review over the Mac, over at the Mac Observer of iOS 8, that you can press and hold on the little globe button and you'll get a pop-up menu and you can select directly whichever alternate keyboard you want to pick. So there's a little tip for you on keyboards. Voice messaging in the messaging app, that's really fun. If you tap on the mic icon now, you can start recording a message, and then you can either tap the X to cancel it if you don't like what you recorded and re-record, or if you've recorded it and you're ready to send it, you just swipe up after recording and it'll send that message. And the person that you're sending to doesn't have to be on iOS 8, or I don't even think they have to be on an iPhone. It's just going to send an audio recording like an MMS. So rather than a picture, it'll send an audio recording. And there's also a quick photo feature. If you are the type of person that likes to take selfies, there's a little photo button on the other side. You can tap that and swipe up to take a quick photo, tap and swipe to the right to do a quick video recording. And when you do that, it'll automatically send. If you don't want to do that, you can tap and then just press the photo key when you're ready to take your photo. So play around with that, and that's some cool new features in messaging. And also related to messaging, when you receive a message, you can now do a quick reply from the notification center. So, you know, when the little notification badge sort of slides down from the top of your phone, if you tap on that and slide down, you'll get an input box. You can type right in and then reply, which is really great if you're already in another application working and that message comes in. You don't have to leave the app you're in. You don't have to go back over to the Messages app to actually reply to that. So that's really neat. The Photos app has a new time-lapse photo mode. So now, in addition to video and slow motion, you can swipe over and get to time-lapse videos. A feature I'm really enjoying is Hey Siri. And I apologize to everyone whose phone just went off right now. If you have your phone plugged into power and you say those words, I'm not going to say them again, Siri will wake up and then you can give a voice command without having to, or a Siri command without actually having to even touch the phone or touch the home button. And I'm absolutely loving that in the car. I'm loving it when I'm here at my desk. I can do all kinds of searches and look up things and get information without having to take my hands off the keyboard or hands off the wheel. It's really, really nice. So play around with that and let me know what you think. There's also now the ability to add notification widgets to the notification center, and a lot of applications were updated. So I guess another thing, after you upgrade to iOS 8, you may want to jump into the App Store and check for app updates. You'll probably be surprised by how many developers have upgraded their apps for iOS 8 support and added support for a bunch of these new features. So Notification Center widgets, again, if you have certain apps installed and they support Notification Center widgets, what you'll do is go into the Today view of your Notification Center, scroll all the way to the bottom, and you'll now see an Edit button. And then you can tap the little plus icon next to any widgets that you want to add to Notification Center. And again, you have the little tap handles so you can drag and prioritize the order that they'll show up in your Today view and Notification Center. And then hit Done. And now when you open up Notification Center, you can get information from third-party apps or little tools. Like, I know some calculator apps are making calculators available in there. You can get additional weather information, file information. I think Dropbox has one that'll show you the latest files that have been updated in your Dropbox app, all that sort of stuff. So pretty neat, and I think we're going to be seeing a lot of very creative widgets available for Notification Center. Another real handy thing that iOS 8 brings is the ability to check which applications are using up your battery. So if you've got apps running in the background and you want to know how much battery they're using up, you can go into Settings, General Usage, and there's a new Battery Usage section. It'll show you how much power each app is actively using on your phone. So then you can quit out any maybe power-hungry apps that you don't necessarily need running in the background and get better battery life. So that's a good thing. Can you tell iOS 8 is just loaded with cool stuff? I could probably go all day. I'm going to try and get through this last few because we're going to have a really long show here. But another thing in messages, you can now have a read all option to mark all of your messages as read. So tap edit in messages and you'll see that option there. Also in settings, you can go into settings messages and choose to auto delete older messages after 30 days or 1 year. I think the default is forever. But you know, if you're like me, you don't want to have messages around forever and ever. They can be taking up space, especially if they have images. Maybe you want them to delete after 30 days or a year. That can happen automatically now just in by changing that setting. Safari has some cool new features. This one's really neat. If you swipe down in the bookmark bar area, so when you're editing a URL, that area that's under the URL bar has your favorites in there, you can pull down and you'll see some additional options, including request desktop site. So how many times have you been to a site and they have a really bad mobile version and you're like, can you just give me the desktop version? Just pull down, tap on that. You don't have to go hunting around on the page for the desktop button on the site itself. And that will get reset the next time you quit Safari and restart it. That will go away. There's also an add to favorites option there sort of hidden under the bookmark bar. So play around with that. And if you're a person who likes RSS feeds, you can now have RSS feeds in Safari Mobile. It'll be under the shared links section. So that's when you hit the little bookmarks button and you go to the shared links tab, which is the little at symbol. Tap on that. And with the website open, you can tap on the subscriptions link at the bottom and then tap add current site, and that will add it to your shared links list. The only thing I noticed here that's a little bit weird is that the RSS feed items show up way down at the bottom of that list, because that shared links list also has any URLs that people are sharing with you on Twitter, if you've enabled that feature. So those will usually show up at the top, and I didn't see any way to control the order of that. So if you're not seeing them after adding an RSS feed, just scroll way down to the bottom and you'll likely find them there. You can now also use your iSight camera when you're in Safari on a website making an online order to enter your credit card details. So you can just take a picture of the front of your credit card. It'll fill in all the credit card details for you automatically without having to type all that stuff in. So that's pretty cool until we get Apple Pay and we're able to use maybe Apple Pay at some time in the future on a website. And then there's one bummer thing that happened that I found out about. Looks like Apple removed the Raise to Talk feature for Siri. A lot of people are saying this is removed because now you have Raise to Talk in messages. I'm not necessarily buying that, because they could make that still work and still have Raise to Talk when I'm just on my home screen or in other apps for Safari. I use that feature all the time. When I was out in public, I wanted to use Siri to maybe send a message or do something, but I didn't want to look like a dork holding my phone in my hand and just like shouting into it in the middle of a public space. By holding it up to your ear, it looks like you're just making a phone call, which people do all the time. It's very normal. So I'm sorry to see that feature go. A lot of people are speculating it may have been removed because of the power requirement. You know, it uses up extra battery for Siri to be sitting there waiting for you to kind of raise the phone to actually activate. I don't know if that's true or not, but I was bummed to see that go, and that's missing. So if you relied on that feature, just be aware of that. Another thing that happened right after the launch is apparently there was a bug discovered with HealthKit. So there were a couple apps that were updated to take advantage of HealthKit and the new Health app to help, you know, sort of aggregate your data in there. Unfortunately, Apple pulled all of the HealthKit supporting apps due to some sort of bug. They're aware of it. They made a public statement. They're working on it, but we don't know when those apps might return. They said, they committed to getting them back and getting the bug fixed before the end of the month. So hopefully that will happen sooner or later, because I know a lot of people were really looking forward to the Health app. Sort of hobbles the Health app right now at this point. There's not much you can do. It has your tracking data. You know, the M7 coprocessor, M8 coprocessor data is going to be in there, but third-party apps aren't going to be able to tap into it just quite yet. So that's some of the cool things you might want to check out once you've upgraded to iOS 8. Also make you aware, they did push out an update for the Apple TV. I think Apple TV version 5. I didn't write this in my notes, but I think I read that somewhere. Hopefully I'm getting that right. It has a new flatter UI. They added a Beats Music app, and it also adds support for the new family sharing feature that's in iOS 8. I haven't played around with family sharing yet. but I've been reading a lot about it. It sounds amazing. This is the thing that will allow you to have family members with their own iCloud accounts, but then aggregate them together so that you can share your purchases, your music, your movies, your apps, all those sorts of things between family members. And I think it's going to make it much easier for all of us to have separate iCloud accounts, keep certain things separate, but also be able to kind of take advantage of all of our purchases and stuff like that. So I'm looking forward to actually using that. I just haven't enabled it, but I'll share my thoughts and observations with you once I've done that and sort of played around with it a little bit. Apple also pushed out an update for OS X Mavericks. OS X Mavericks 10.9.5 was released. It has a couple things in it. Improves reliability of VPN connections that use USB smart cards for authentication. Also improves reliability of accessing files located on SMB servers. That's great for those of you who are in mixed environments, business environments. And also includes Safari 7.0.6, which was already released. So I think it has that along with probably some minor bug fixes, enhancements, and those sorts of things. So if you missed that in the whole turmoil, or I guess it wasn't really turmoil, in the whole craziness of iOS 8 coming out, then make sure you run software update on your Mac or open up the App Store, and you should see that update waiting for you. But that's all the kind of latest and greatest on iOS 8 and some of the Apple updates. Another thing to talk about, I guess, that's somewhat related to iOS 8, specifically because they have the new iCloud Drive and iCloud Photo Library that we're going to be talking about in a bit. All that stuff that takes advantage of your iCloud storage. Apple did announce new iCloud pricing. You still get 5 gigabytes for free, but now 20 gigabytes will run you 99 cents, just 99 cents a month, 200 gigabytes for $3.99 a month. And of course, these are all in US dollars, so adjust for your regional location. 500 gigabytes for $9.99 a month, and 1 terabyte is now $20 a month, $19.99 a month. And I think that's down about half, still not as low as a service like Dropbox. But remember, this is going to be integrated with everything that you're doing on your iOS devices and your Mac. So I think Apple's maybe thinking they can charge a little bit of a premium for that. And I think they're probably right. If you're a customer that's already been paying for an iCloud plan and you're at the old rates, good news is that you should have received an email. Apple is giving prorated refunds for those of you. So, you know, if you just signed up the day before they had this new pricing, Apple's going to take care of you. They're going to put you under the new pricing and they're going to give you a prorated credit. So you should have gotten that email. If you didn't, you should get the credit. So that's good news on the iCloud pricing. And I'm thinking probably with some of the new features, I'm probably going to finally get back on a paid iCloud plan. And I'm looking at that 200 gigabytes for $4 a month. I think that's a pretty good deal, or maybe the 500 gigs. You know, I remember when we did pay for iCloud, it was like $99 a year. I guess it was Mobile Me at the time, right? So I wouldn't mind going back to paying that for these kinds of services if they really work. But I'm going to have to play around with them a little bit. I am looking forward to iCloud Drive once we're able to actually use it. So hopefully with Mavericks, we'll be able to all upgrade to that. And that's when I think I'm actually going to be upgrading. Another thing Apple did this week in the wake of what many are calling NudeGate, the whole selfie leak thing. And we talked about that, how crazy that was, and sort of where there's some blame on Apple's part, but definitely not all the blame and those sorts of things. Go back and listen to that episode if you missed it. But Apple did commit that they were going to beef up iCloud security, and they definitely followed through. A couple things that are happening now you should be aware of. Apple now, by default, will send an email whenever you log into your iCloud account through a web browser. So if you log in and out of iCloud, I thought this might get annoying, but I played around with it a little bit. I don't know if there's sort of a timing feature, or they check, you know, which browser you've logged into, or sort of keep track of IP. But it seems like, you know, if you're logging in and out one time after another, you only get one email. But if you wait a certain period of time, I don't know what that might be, a day or two, probably every 24 hours. So they probably only send you one email per 24-hour period. Or if they see an IP address change, I would imagine they would send you an email. But I'll have to play around with that a little bit more to see how it works. But certainly it would get annoying if every time you logged into iCloud, you got an email. But good to know that, you know, your account's being accessed. So they did that. They also have now enabled two-factor authentication in iCloud. And I think they had this in the past and then sort of got rid of it on iCloud.com, but it's back. So now if you are using two-factor authentication on your Apple ID, when you log into iCloud, you'll be asked to verify that. It'll send a text notification to your phone, and you'll have to enter in a little phone number. And again, it'll give you the option to remember that verification per browser. So you can set that so if you know you're always logging in from your home computer, you don't have to verify every single time on the two-factor. And it will also remind you when you log out, you know, do you want to stay logged in or verified on this computer? And you can change that option when you're logging out of iCloud.com. And then related to the iCloud two-factor stuff, if you are using two-factor, starting October 1st, if you have third-party apps that use iCloud services, they're going to require what's called an app-specific password. So you're not going to, after October 1st, be able to log in to iCloud with those apps using your standard iCloud.com login. You're going to have to generate an app-specific password. These can be generated by logging into your Apple ID account page and then clicking on the password and security section, then clicking on Generate App-Specific Password. And then you'll set a specific password for the app. It will give it to you, or it might be even a suggestion. And then you'll use that password within your third-party app to log in. So you still use your iCloud email address. You just use that app-specific password. And they're saying you can set up to 25 app-specific passwords. There's a little view history button that's in that same section that'll show all of the previously generated app-specific passwords and also give you the option to revoke them. But I assume you can probably use the same app-specific password for more than one app. It would kind of mess up the whole revocability, but, you know, I have a feeling a lot of us are going to need more than 25. So, like, for example, I might set one up just for email accounts that access or email services that access iCloud. Or, for example, I use BusyCal or calendar services that, you know, along with Fantastical. So both of those need to access my iCloud account. I might just set up one calendar app specific app password and then use that for everything. And the whole idea behind an app specific password is that if you give it to an app and then suddenly stop using that app or especially with web apps, that thing does not have your passwords, your actual iCloud password stored in some database somewhere, right? It's better protection for those passwords, and that's why Apple's going to that model. And, you know, the two-factor thing is great. It's the right thing to do, I think, for Apple to do. But as far as it changing anything with what happened with the whole NudeGate thing, I don't think it would have made a difference because the attackers went through a whole back-end API which didn't have two-factor checking turned on. The app-specific passwords would probably handle that a lot better because the reason that whole hack happened is they targeted specific accounts and used the forgot password feature with the security questions to actually get passwords of the people they were attacking and then use those passwords on, you know, those known passwords on the back-end API to actually break in. So, you know, it wasn't sort of a hack where they just randomly guessed passwords, those sorts of things. There may have been some of that going on. Details are a bit sketchy, but it was definitely the kind of thing where there just wasn't a secure password. So obviously having app-specific passwords would make it a lot harder for those passwords to sort of get uncovered. So good news that Apple's, you know, doing better protection for us all the way around. They also updated some stuff related to their privacy, including adding a lot more transparency to the things that they're doing with privacy by putting up a whole new web page on their site. So if you go to apple.com/privacy, there's a letter there from Tim Cook that reiterates comments that he's made several times in the past that, you know, Apple makes money from its products, not its customers' data. So they're not really interested in, you know, gathering a bunch of data and selling that to advertisers and those sorts of things. And as sort of backing that up, if you're running iOS 8, this is a nice new update, and you use a passcode or Touch ID on your iPhone or iPad, and I really recommend that everybody does that. It now appears that the majority of your data will be encrypted, and Apple will not have the keys anymore for that encryption, so they will not be able to access that data information, even if they receive a warrant from law enforcement. They just literally cannot get at that data. So only you with your passcode will be able to get at that data. So it's much better protected. So that now includes photos, messages, including your attachments, email, contacts, your call history, your iTunes content, your notes, your reminders, all of that stuff is protected. Third-party app data was always protected before, so it's basically everything on your iPhone is going to be protected and encrypted if you're setting a passcode lock. So just another reason to do that. It helps maintain your privacy. And if you want to know more details about everything that Apple is doing in that privacy realm and sort of how they're handling thing in really pretty good plain English language, check out apple.com/privacy. We're beginning to get some more information and details about Apple's watch, and not all of it is, I think, all that exciting. Well, I think some of it was actually predictable, and the first thing that we learned is that gold is going to be expensive. I don't think that shocks anyone, but we just really didn't know how expensive. Estimates are starting to come in, and there is a wide range. So I guess, you know, decide who you want to believe on this one. But TechCrunch is estimating that the gold version, the Apple Edition Apple Watch, is going to run around $1,200 US. Although one expert said that just the casing alone, if it's in gold, could cost about $600 just to even produce. So the $1,200 price, that could be very in the range. Although I'll have to warn you, that is one of the lower estimates that we're hearing. And it's not clear at this point if it'll be gold-plated or gold alloy. I heard Rene Ritchie say it was gold-plated, and I know he was at the Apple event. I heard that on a recent podcast. I don't know if he specifically asked that or just assumed that. Gold-plated would obviously be less expensive than solid gold alloy. But Apple did make a good point of saying their metallurgists sort of made a special kind of gold that was like twice as durable. So you would think it might actually be solid gold. And John Gruber does seem to think that it is solid and could sell for as much as $4,999. I know, what? $5,000 watch. And I guess that's not out of the realm in watch world, but in tech world, that just seems crazy. He's, you know, stated in his piece, at a bare minimum, he thinks it would be about $1,999, but doubts it would be that cheap. Cheap? $2,000. That's a bit pricey. And the bummer is that he puts pricing on the stainless steel sapphire Apple Watch, not the edition, not the gold one, but just the Apple Watch, at about $1,000, $999. The sport edition is the one that starts at $349. It has Ion X glass, I think, is aluminum and has the polymer band, so it has kind of cheaper components. That's pricey to begin with. I was hoping the Apple Watch wouldn't be that much more expensive. I figured a couple $100, maybe $200 more to get the sapphire glass, but that sapphire and stainless steel must be expensive if it's going to be starting at $1,000. So prepare your wallets, but I have a feeling Apple's going to sell a lot more sport edition watches than anything else if that's the case. But I could be proven wrong, and maybe they're going to make a ton of money. I mean, this is ultimately, to a certain degree, jewelry, and I think they're going to be marketing that. I think they're going to be really playing up, and already have with the different kinds of bands and styles and stuff like that, really playing up the whole fashion side of things, the whole prestige side of things. That sort of stuff, I think, is really going to come into play. And, you know, I'm sure we're going to be seeing a lot of celebrities, sports celebrities, Hollywood celebrities, people wearing Apple Watches, and that's going to just do nothing but help sales as well. As far as playing music on it, we had heard them say you could play music on it. There was some question about how you would do that. It can store and play music. You're going to need a Bluetooth headset for that. Apple doesn't currently sell a Bluetooth headset, but, you know, with Beats headphones as part of their portfolio now, I have a feeling we might see a really nice pair of Bluetooth headphones or earbuds or something come out and be released at the same time as the Apple Watch. That would not surprise me in the least. And then one other interesting little tidbit that was uncovered by Cult of Mac, actually via a post on the Quartz Watch blog, is that Apple set the time on their marketing images to 1 minute earlier than most other watchmakers. I guess there is a history, sort of a tradition. It's unspoken. It's not a rule that every manufacturer follows, but there is this sort of concept that you set the time in your marketing images of your watch, of your analog watch, to 10:10. And it was a tradition set by the Hamilton Watch Company back in 1929. And that specific time was picked because it's symmetrical. You have the hands symmetrically on both sides of the 12, and because it doesn't obscure the maker's logo, which is typically below the number 12 on the watch. So 10:10 is the historic time, or sort of the time that most companies use. Apple used 10:09. So I don't know if that's sort of thumbing their nose at the watch industry, saying we're just, you know, we're a little bit better, we're a little bit earlier than the rest of you, although technically I guess they're really later to the market, but you get the idea, right? So that was interesting to read about. So how did you feel about getting a free U2 album? I didn't think it was that big of a deal. I actually, you know, I'm not a huge U2 fan. I'm a bit ambivalent about the band. I like some of their music. I don't necessarily hate their music. But man, the reactions to Apple giving everybody a free album were a bit odd. And that wasn't a cheap thing for them to do. Sources told the New York Times that the deal for Apple to give away the latest U2 album cost the company over $100 million. And I thought I read, too, that Apple also needed to spend another $100 million on an advertising campaign, which they kicked off. I don't know if you've seen the U2 ad that they're running that sort of promotes the new album. But not everyone was happy about getting that for free. I think, you know, the first day, there were people looking for it, although reports say that only about 1% of iTunes customers actually downloaded the album from their iTunes account. It was a bit hard to find. It took me a little while to figure out where it was. It's actually in the purchase section of your iTunes library. So you could go in there and then you kind of had to click to download it. But I guess what happened was because the actual people downloading it weren't that high. Sounds like Apple eventually, and I think they probably planned to do this from the very beginning anyway, and maybe it just took a while for the technology to kick in. Apple pushed the track to people's devices, and that's when things got really ugly. The internet rage on Twitter just exploded, and some people were not thrilled at all. And I guess I get that some people maybe don't like U2 and don't want the album and felt like getting it pushed to them was a bit much, maybe because of some of the bandwidth that was used. I guess if it was pushed over cellular, that's actually a cost to you. So maybe that's a little bit of a deal breaker. Also, it would eat up storage on your device and if you're low on storage. But I really didn't understand the amount of rage related to what was actually happening. You were getting a free album. And I get how some people were also, people unaware that the promotion was going on might have been a little bit worried that their accounts had been hacked, especially in the wake of the whole Nudegate thing that we talked about earlier. Suddenly this album shows up in your library. You think, oh, maybe somebody purchased the thing on my account without my permission and without my knowledge. I get that. But the reaction to me just seemed way over the top. And Apple's counter reaction to it was, in my opinion, even more odd, because this week they set up a dedicated page to allow you to remove, and not just remove, to completely expunge the offensive album, offensive to some people, I guess, from your iTunes library. I definitely wasn't offended. It's free music, people. You don't have to listen to it. But if you hate it, you're like, I don't want it, you want to get it out of your library, Apple set up this special page. You go to itunes.com/SOI-remove. SOI is for the album title, Songs of Innocence. So SOI-remove, itunes.com/SOI-remove. And then you can click on Remove Album to confirm that you want to remove the album from your account. And when you do that, you'll be asked to sign in with your Apple ID and password, the one that you use to buy content from the iTunes store. And then you'll get a confirmation message saying that the album was removed from your account. If you downloaded the songs already, or if they were forced out and already pushed down to your Mac, PC, or your iPhone, iPad, whatever, you will still have to go back and manually delete them. But once you've done that, there will be no trace of the U2 album anywhere in your account. And just be aware, there's no going back, though. If you go down this path, you can't change your mind and get the album back. So you want to make sure that you really, really want to get rid of it. I frankly think most people should have just deleted the album from their iTunes library and from their music, and then you can go into your account and hide it from your purchase history, never see it again, and move on with your life. But at least you still have the album. I don't know why you don't want a free album. And, you know, Peter Cohen over at iMore, I think, had a great take on it. He said, you know, you're basically looking a gift horse in the mouth and freaking out over something that is really not that big a deal. Just delete it and move on. But apparently Apple thought enough people had a cause to not want the album that they gave you the ability to remove it. So there you go. So what's next for Apple? Well, we've got some new rumors already in the mix. Rumors of a 12-inch notebook in an ultra-slim form factor. This sounds suspiciously like a lot of the rumors we've heard in the past, just sort of wrapped up in a new rumor. They're saying 12-inch model MacBook Air, I would assume, with a Retina display, a buttonless trackpad, a new fanless design, likely incorporating the Intel Broadcore M chip. So that's the first series Broadwell chips that are coming out from Intel. I think they're coming out about now or toward the end of the year or early 2015. The odd thing about this one is they're saying it might possibly come in iPhone colors, space gray and gold, along with the traditional sort of silver that we're used to with MacBook. So it sounds like a 12-inch MacBook Air could be some sort of strange variation of that rumored iPad Pro. I don't really know. They're saying it's going to be ready around mid-2012. I'm thinking 12-inch MacBook Air, though, is the most likely thing. It's just that sort of iPhone colors thing makes it sound like it would be more like an iPad. And I still think, you know, maybe Apple's playing around with some sort of weird hybrid sort of machine with like a, you know, more physical click-on key, you know, not physical, but aluminum click-on keyboard sort of thing that would attach to a larger screen iPad Pro. And maybe that's the thing that is being rumored here. But we'll have to wait and see on that one. We're also hearing already, you know, about the next Apple Watch. It's not even going to be out until next year, but we're already getting rumors of what Apple's planning to do with the Apple Watch 2. That's not really surprising. And also not really surprising is they're saying the focus is going to be on more health features and more advanced sensors. I would imagine also much better battery life based on, you know, we're hearing that it's probably going to have about 12 hours of battery life. Basically, Apple's saying you're going to have to charge it at the end of every day. So they're going to probably be working on that. I'm sure it's going to be slimmer, you know, all the typical things in next generation version. But I think they want to push more and more into that health side of things. So be able to monitor more things about your health, tie in more tightly with health apps and with your doctors and hospitals and things like that. So I think all of that makes sense for the next generation watch. We're also hearing some good news about potentially a new iMac in the works, and not just a 4K iMac, a 5K iMac. You know, why do 4K when you can go straight to 5? Apple hasn't even done a 4K version, but sounding like, and this rumor comes from a Taiwan-based display research company called Witsview, they're saying there's going to be a 5K iMac. Dell actually just announced a 27-inch 5K display, so they could be using similar kinds of panels. And as a matter of fact, OS X Yosemite also has hinted at a pixel-doubled retina resolution display option for a desktop Mac. So we've seen these sort of high DPI resolutions in OS X Yosemite, so that would make sense that Apple might be working on some new version of a desktop. And they did also recently add some resolution scaling options and improved 4K support for displays into the operating system. So if that is true, then maybe there is a new high-resolution iMac in our futures. And there's even more, because Apple has said that in an interview, Tim Cook was on TV with Charlie Rose and said that there are Apple products in development that haven't even been rumored about yet. Please say teleporters. Please say teleporters. but again, I don't know that that's all that revealing, right? Apple's working on new stuff all of the time. I guess the big news there is that we don't even have rumors about what Apple might be working on. So it's probably not any of those things that I just mentioned earlier. It's something entirely different. And as far as when Apple's next big event might be, reportedly we're going to get another Apple event in late to mid-October. Historically, that's been the case. Typically there we see new iPad updates, so it's very likely we're going to get some iPad updates. I'm guessing improved processors, not huge design changes. Also the Touch ID upgrades for both the iPad Air and the iPad Mini. And I would think we'd also get a ship date for OS X Yosemite at that time, maybe even on the day of the event. They'll have OS X Yosemite ready to ship. Possibly we'll hear about new MacBook Pros or Air updates. There are some sort of upgraded Intel processors they could use, not Broadwell, but the updated current versions. And, you know, as noted earlier, the Air might not come until 2015. Another thing that's been missing from Apple's lineup for a while is a 4K Retina Thunderbolt display. That'd be great to see there. I haven't heard any strong rumors around that, but that seems like it could happen. And maybe even an Apple TV update, although I think that's unlikely. I think we're going to be stuck with Apple's current Apple TV lineup, at least through the end of this year. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Now I want to jump into a lot of your feedback on the Apple event. I got a ton of voicemails and emails related to that. So I just wanted to run through some of those, starting with this question from James.
Hey, Adam, it's James up here in Canada. Just want to say I'm a longtime listener and really enjoy the show. My question is that do you think we'll see a huge movement towards the 5.5-inch iPhones from here on? And what I mean to say by that is, from what I've seen online, from some of the polls that have been started, a lot of people have gotten the 5.5-inch model, not necessarily for the extra size, but because of the extra features over the 4.7-inch model. Come next year, if Apple is to make both phones identical in terms of the features, that, you know, with battery life obviously being probably the only differentiating factor, if people get used to the 5.5-inch model and end up sticking with it. Anyway, just wondering what your thoughts are on that. Love the show. Keep it up. Thanks.
Hey, thanks, James. Yeah, I think that the larger sizes are going to become the norm, the two sizes, I think, because I think not everybody is going to fall in or really want that really large, gigantophone 5.5-inch form factor. What wouldn't surprise me is if we saw Apple move to just those two sizes. So sort of end of life or get rid of the 5-inch model, the 5S, the 5C, and replace that with a 4.7-inch model on the bottom end. So sort of move down the 6 into that range and then have two sizes of the iPhone 7, I guess it would be. And that's the way it would be going moving forward. And whether they stick with 4.7 and 5.5, I think those are pretty good sizes. I don't see Apple going bigger than 5.5. And I think the 4.7 is sort of a nice compromise on still having a big phone, enough screen real estate to do all the stuff that you want, but not being overly huge and still sort of being pocketable. I'll have to see, you know, once I have them in my hands, hopefully I'll have some time tomorrow at the Apple Store to play around with the iPhone 6 and the 4.7 configuration, kind of compare that to my iPhone 5S and see how I feel about that. But that almost seems like the perfect size phone for a lot of people. If Apple can, like you said, bring some of the same features to that phone and sort of bring it in line and bring it in parity to where to the point where the only feature difference is really maybe screen size and battery life, because obviously with a larger phone, you can have larger batteries. So I would tend to agree with that, but I don't think we're going to end up back at just one phone size being that sort of gigantophone size, if you know what I mean, or if that makes sense. And now staying up north in Canada, we also had some questions come in about the Apple Watch, not all from Canada, but this first one is from Rick, and he was a little bit disappointed, I think, in what Apple announced.
Hi, this is Rick from Ontario, Canada calling. I just wanted to comment on my views of the iWatch, or sorry, the Apple Watch. I'm a little bit disappointed. I'm into running and a little bit of triathlon stuff, and I really don't like having to carry my iPhone with me when I'm running, but I have been doing that just to take care to use the Runkeeper app, and it's really nice, and it's telling me in my earphones like my pace and how I can keep on my pace and my goals and everything, and just it's really nice while you're running, and it maps it all out, GPS. And I was really hoping that this iWatch or Apple Watch was gonna have a GPS in it and be able to Because what's the point of me having to carry my phone and wear a watch while I'm running? And especially now that the phone is bigger. Both are bigger. Even the, if I don't want to go for the big one, even the 4.7 is bigger than my 5S. So it's just going to be this big bulky thing I have to wear on my arm or put in my pocket while I'm running, which is just not going to happen. So I'm going to stick with my 5S, and I don't want to go any bigger than the 5S. And I'm not going to get an Apple Watch because it's going to be useless to me. I'm really disappointed in that. I'm hoping the second generation will have a GPS antenna in it. Another thing is, I just thought of a solution to that, is why did they not take advantage of the band and put an antenna or sensors in the actual band, that instead of making it just some pretty thing that you put on your wrist, have it actually be useful, and they could take advantage of that space and put wrap a flexible GPS antenna and Wi-Fi antenna in the band itself. I'm pretty disappointed, and I hope it gets better. Thanks. Bye.
Hey, James, I think it is going to get better, and that's the good thing about this. This is really a 1.0 product, and that's not to make any kinds of excuses for it, because I was also disappointed that it doesn't seem like it has as much autonomy as I would have liked. I really thought that it needed to stand a little bit more on its own as a device. We're starting to get some information that there will be some things that you can actually do with that, with it, without having it attached to your iPhone. I wish we knew a little bit more about that S1 processor that's in there, but I would imagine that it has some low energy sensor tracking capabilities like the M7 and M8 chips do. So being able to sort of keep track of counting your steps and your heart rate, stuff like that inside the watch. It sounds like we do know you can put your music on the watch. So there's definitely some functionality that we really don't know a lot about yet that's in there that I think we're going to be surprised by. So I think I'm tentatively hopeful that there's some details about the Apple Watch that just haven't been sorted out, right? It's not even, we don't even have the actual 1.0 product yet. It's really still in development. So what we've seen so far is, I think, more like a late stage beta. That's why we don't have information on battery life. We don't have, you know, I think some things are in flux and Apple's trying to get some things in there. I understand, you know, wanting to have GPS in there and not having to carry a phone around. The thing with GPS is that would be really hard to build into something that small and maintain any kind of semblance of battery life. If you look at the GPS on your phone when that's enabled, it just sucks the battery out of that like you wouldn't believe, and it would be such a technical challenge. It's probably one of the major reasons why Apple didn't put GPS in there, and I don't know if they ever would be able to. I like your idea about, you know, putting the antennas in the band, but I don't think that's the thing that's holding it back, is where to sort of put the GPS antennas, those sorts of things. I think it really comes down to battery life and something that's really that small. That's not saying they can't eventually get it in there, but it's going to have to be some sort of newer technology, I think, than the current sort of GPS technologies we have. That said, I don't know a ton about GPS technology, so maybe there's something that I'm overlooking there. I'm willing to sort of admit that. But I think even more disappointing was the fact that it's not waterproof. As far as swimming, triathlons, those sorts of things, having to take it off, I find that to be a pretty big disappointment. But overall, I think it's very exciting, all the stuff that is in there and all the stuff that it can do. And for apps like RunKeeper, I think they're going to jump on board with the integration with the iPhone. So I think having the Apple Watch and the RunKeeper app on your iPhone might give you an even better, more holistic experience. I'm sure they're going to integrate with HealthKit and the Health app. So being able to aggregate your workout data, those sorts of things, into one place, I think is going to be very valuable. You said you're already carrying your iPhone now, so it's just really not going to change. You know, you don't want to, but you've been doing it because of the app and the functionality. And I think when that's further expanded, you're going to be even more happy to be, you know, having your iPhone with you, or more accepting of it is probably the better way to put it based on some of your comments. So I would, you know, reserve judgment till we actually have the shipping product, but you're probably right. Maybe the 1.0 version isn't going to be the version for you, but 2.0 probably will be some amazing things, and that may be when you jump on board. As far as the iPhone goes too, the iPhone 5S versus the 6, it's really not that big of a size difference. So I think, you know, if you go into an Apple store and you compare the two side by side, I don't think that's as much of a deterrent. It's just a hair wider and a little bit taller. I think you'll be surprised by the size difference. And you remember going from the 5 to the 5S was even a little bit jarring. I mentioned that earlier in the podcast, and we kind of all got over that. Now, I'd almost say that the 4S and the 3.5-inch phones really feel tiny in comparison. So I think we might have some of that going on, too. It's just, you know, moving forward, anytime stuff changes, it takes a little bit of getting used to. So I would say hang in there. And you weren't the only one with an Apple Watch question. We also got this question from Alan.
Hi, Adam. This is Alan from Honolulu, Hawaii, calling. I just listened to the episode, the Apple iPhone 6 Apple Watch special Maccast that you just did. Wow, that was really a lot of information. I watched the keynote. I didn't watch it live. I watched it delayed later on Apple TV. But you hit a lot of points that I missed in the in the keynote. Appreciate your thoroughness. I guess I was distracted with the kids running around the house while I was watching it. Anyway, just quick comment about the Apple Watch. I'm not sure if I want to get it. My wife really wants to get it. She wants to get it today. But, you know, one thing that really surprised me is I haven't seen Apple pre-release something like this probably maybe 6 months in advance. If it's first quarter or release, probably March, right? Like you were saying in the podcast. Wow, I can't remember the last thing that they've ever released that far in advance. Or, can you think of anything that's been that far in advance? You know, I've only been, really following Apple since just before the iPhone was released. Actually, that's when I started listening to the Maccast. Probably be around 2005 or so. Anyway, just to drop you a quick line to see your comments on that. Thanks. Keep up the good work on the Maccast. Appreciate it. Bye.
Can you believe that actually the iPhone was released in 2007? As a matter of fact, it was announced in January 2007. And to answer your question, that is the first product that I can think of that was announced that far in advance. It was announced in January and didn't go on sale until the end of June. So just about 6 months on that one. And the reason they announced that so early, and likely the reason they announced the iWatch so early, is the device at some point is going to have to go through FCC and other regulatory approvals. And when that happens, that information becomes public. So it would sort of out itself that it was in development. There'd be diagrams leaked, those sorts of things, and people would know about it anyway. So to sort of cut that off and make sure that Apple gets to kind of control the message and control the announcement, they announced it that early. And they did that with the iPhone because the iPhone was a whole brand new category, brand new product. And I think that's why they're doing it with the iWatch as well. I don't expect future versions of the iWatch to be announced this far in advance. It also, you know, might be because they're going to be moving into ramping up some pre-production models and doing some trials, and leaks start to happen then as well. So I think there's the whole leak aspect. The other thing is, and I don't know if this was just a bonus or if this was tactically sort of planned by Apple, is it effectively halted the holiday sales of any competing smartwatch products, right? Anybody who was maybe starting to get tired of waiting for Apple to do something and considering a Samsung Gear, one of the new Moto 360s, which looks beautiful, they may hold off now on their purchase and actually wait until next year for the iWatch. So I think Apple was looking at, we're moving into the holiday season. Our product's going to come out early 2015. We don't want to lose a sale to someone because we don't have a product in the market for the holidays. We're not going to have a product there. So let's go ahead and announce it and sort of cut that off. So I think there were kind of multiple reasons for Apple to do it that far in advance. But I think the most sort of logical is just that they knew leaks were going to start and they sort of wanted to make sure that they controlled the message. And then finally, we did get one more question about the Apple Watch. This one came from Todd.
Hey, Adam, what's going on? This is Todd in Southington, Connecticut. I'm a phys ed teacher in elementary school, and I have an iPod Touch that I use to play music in my gym. I could plug that in to an XLR plug that's in the wall, and it plays right to the overhead speaker. And I was pretty excited about the Apple Watch because now I'm thinking I can control my device with the Apple Watch. If I'm, you know, away from the iPod Touch in the gym and just, you know, tap the watch, but I'm not seeing iPod Touch being supported. I do have an iPhone 5S that I certainly would use if it came to it, but I'm just curious why iPod wouldn't be supported. Does it have to do with one of the Bluetooth, or does it need a cellular connection? Not sure, but hopefully you can answer my question. Hope all is well, and enjoy the show. Thanks.
Hey, Todd, thanks for the question. Yeah, I'm not really sure why at least the latest iPod Touch wouldn't be supported. And without being able to ask Apple directly, we can really only speculate. Bluetooth would be the connection, I would think, to the Apple Watch. And the iPod Touch does have Bluetooth 4.0, so you would think that it would work. But maybe it's because they do need to rely on cellular, or they just want something that can have an always-on data connection, since that's really the iWatch's or the Apple Watch's tether to the internet. Also, the iPod Touch doesn't have GPS, so maybe a lot of the health and fitness features that rely on GPS just wouldn't work without that kind of connectivity. That's probably the most logical explanation there. Or maybe the other thing I could think of is maybe there's some sort of connection with the M7 or M8 motion coprocessors. Again, something that you wouldn't find in an iPod Touch, although both those seem more like they would be fitness tracking related. And that is part of the watch itself, as near as we can tell with that S1. So, you know, considering all that stuff, I'm sort of putting the thing on it doesn't have GPS is the most likely explanation for it sort of not being able to work with the iPod Touch. I would imagine maybe sometime in the future they'll integrate that. But again, I think it's still really early. There's a number of changes we could see with the Apple Watch before it ships. And, you know, maybe iPod Touch support in some capacity could come to play. I kind of doubt it, though. Apple was pretty clear about it requiring an iPhone and sort of being this iPhone accessory device. And you know, as you heard earlier, there's more than a few people that are a little bit disappointed in that. And I count myself in that group a little bit. Like I said, if you listen to my shows before the Apple Watch came out, I really felt that it could be a much more successful device if it had, you know, at least Wi-Fi or some other connectivity in it to make it really autonomous and not require some other device. But this is 1.0, and it's sort of Apple's starting point. They had to start someplace, and it's a pretty impressive start, if you ask me. I'm still blown away by the device, even though it does have that sort of iPhone tether requirement. But I think future versions probably will more and more operate by themselves without any other kind of need for external connectivity, those sorts of things. We're just going to have to wait and see where Apple takes it. And hopefully it's a big enough product and makes it a big enough splash that will continue to happen. And then the last comment I want to play for you today is more about the launch of the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, and has to do with carrier contracts. And something you might want to watch out for, a little sort of warning from listener John, who discovered something during the checkout process that I think many of you might be interested in knowing.
Hi, Adam. This is John from beautiful Palos Verdes, California. Last night, I struggled along with everyone else in ordering my new iPhone 6 Plus 128 gigabytes. Apart from the obvious website malfunctions, it was only when I got to the end of the checkout process that it sunk in that the new pricing is very different from what it was in the past and what I expected. Specifically, the ATT's $499 under contract pricing for that top-end model means you give up the $25 a month discount currently in what has been known as the family share plan. So you're paying a whopping $600 more in order to buy your phone for $499 instead of $949. Further, the ATT Next 12 plan just means you pay for your $949 phone in monthly installments on top of their cellular plan. You continue to get the $25 savings per month as you do with the outright no contract buy, because in both of those options, ATT is not paying any subsidy to Apple. So it finally sunk in that the subsidies are indeed gone. In none of the above options does ATT seem to pay Apple a subsidy. Now it's like buying a car. You can pay cash, you can finance it and pay for it monthly, or you can bury the cost in your monthly plan, which is like a car lease. The implications for users is that under the old rules, you were foolish for not upgrading every 2 years because you paid the premium and baked into the price of the monthly service whether or not you upgrade. It would be equivalent to keeping your car and continuing to pay car lease payments after the 4 years in your contract ran out. Now, you can pay for a lower rate if you don't upgrade, which is good for consumers that don't really need the latest, greatest phone. However, that could make a difference in lengthening the average upgrade cycle, so that could have business implications for Apple. It's important to note that owning a new iPhone does not cost more than it used to, but the monthly charges will jump back up to where they were a year or two ago when these monthly charges included the carrier charges to earn back the subsidy. Also, more people will choose to own their phones outright, since at least that way they can get it unlocked up front and thus have flexibility and freedom to switch carriers and be free to use less expensive SIM cards when traveling outside the United States. I'd love to hear your take on all this. Many of your listeners, I'm sure, are in for a rude awakening next time they buy a new phone under contract, expecting the rest of their plan to stay in place, since that is no longer the no-brainer best option. The subsidies are, for all intents and purposes, gone, and we need to adapt and pick the best solution for each of us. I've been a loyal MacCast listener since day one. I love your show, and please keep up the great work.
Thank you, John. I think that's really good information for people to know and understand. It certainly was something I didn't understand. I went ahead and stayed on contract, but for me, it works out because it's my understanding, and it was. I think this is what you were stating in your comment, that really the people that this affects most are those that are using the family share data plans, and specifically plans that are over 10 gigabytes of shared data. What was happening, just to kind of clarify, was there was a discount applied per line on family share data plans under AT&T, but only for phones on contract. So if you were on contract, there was typically a $40 per device cost, and that was $25. You got a discount of down to $25 for plans 10 gigabytes and under, and also down to $15, so a $25 savings for plans 10 gigabytes or more, and that was per month per device. Now, when you upgrade, you don't have that option. So what'll happen is your device off contract will go up and you will lose that $25 savings. So this can actually end up costing some people, and I know some people have commented on this, can cost them more money over time on their phones that aren't on contract anymore, because when you upgrade to the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, it's my understanding you lose all of that sort of discount per line. I'm going to have to double check and verify with AT&T on that, and John, correct me if my thinking is wrong on that, but that's sort of what I've been reading about. AT&T is no longer offering discounted data rates on non-contract phones. So that means to get that $15 or $25 data access rate plan, like you said, you either need to move to that AT&T Next plan where you pay full for the phone, and actually I think you get it zero up front, but then you pay on your monthly bill extra till you cover the cost of the phone. You buy it outright at the full price, $949 for the iPhone 6 Plus, $128, which I think for a lot of people is going to be the best and option, because like you said, you can get it unlocked right up front, or you bring your own phone. So if you want to get that discounted data rate, you have to do those options. You cannot do it on an on-contract phone. And that's a very good point, and something people should be aware of. And again, I think this really only affects AT&T, but there's other things going on with other carriers. I think the net result is, like you said, though, sort of the carrier subsidies and those days of doing that sort of thing are really gone. I think in the long run, it's going to be better for us as consumers. I would agree with you on that as well, because now we're just buying the phones outright, however we want to do it, whether we want to finance it or pay up front, what have you. But it's going to get rid of a lot of that excess baggage that we had with the carrier subsidies and just not really knowing and being forced to sort of upgrade every 2 years and being locked in with a carrier, those sorts of things. So I like this other methodology better, because that means, especially if you buy it full price up front, you're not going to be kind of locked in and stuck on that contract. And you can kind of, you're free to go when you want and get the best deal wherever that might be. So thanks for all the feedback, everybody. That was great stuff. And I look forward to hearing more from all of you. Another great piece of feedback that I received via email that I think a lot of us should know about, especially if you're someone who travels internationally, you're from the U.S. and you're looking to get and take advantage of those 20 LTE bands that Phil Schiller talked about in the keynote. He made a big deal about how the iPhone 6 now supports more LTE bands than any other phone on the market, 20. And Colin emailed me with some concern about that because he needs a phone that is carrier unlocked and supports all those bands because he travels between the U.S. and China. So he's in both environments, and those extra LTE bands, a lot of them are those bands that are the ones that operate in China. But when he went to look at the tech specs and look at the different models of phones, which on Apple's tech specs page for the iPhone 6 models, it looks like there's three different models, but there's actually what appears to be two different models. There's the A149, A1522 models. And the reason there is two different model numbers is one is the iPhone 6, one is the 6 Plus. So A1549 and A1522 covers the GSM and CDA variants for the different carriers. And although when you're looking at the chart, it looks like the CDMA is a different phone, it seems to be all the same to me, at least as I'm looking at it, because when you look through the bands and you look through the model numbers, there's really only those two model numbers. It's just under the CDMA variant, they list the CDMA bandwidths, and they don't do that under the GSM models. And then under that, you see the second model, which is A1586 and A1524, and those seem to have all the same CDM, GSM, and LTE bands of the 1549 and 1522 models, but then it also adds three additional TD-S CDMA bands, 1900 and 2000, and four TD-LTE bands, 38, 39, 40, and 41. And those are the extra bands, CDMA and LTE, that I think are used on the carriers in China. The thing about it is that means that the 1549, 1522 models, the ones on AT&T and T-Mobile and some of the other carriers, those only have 16 LTE bands, not 20. In order to get the full 20, you have to get that 1586, 1524 model. And digging into the Apple LTE page, so if you go to apple.com/iPhone/LTE, and looking at the carriers, it shows that in the U.S., the LTE band model is only available on CSpire, Sprint, and U.S. Cellular. And the concern from Colin was that Sprint does not seem to offer an option to buy the iPhone 6 models carrier unlocked or off contract. So you'd have to have Sprint as your carrier in the U.S., and Colin really doesn't want to do that in order to get the full 20 LTE bands, which are the ones that he's going to want to be able to use in China. So the question becomes, how can you get the 20 band model carrier unlocked? Is there any way to do that? And I don't see any way to do that on Apple's website. If you look on Apple's website, the only model that they sell off contract, not even unlocked, just off contract, is the T-Mobile GSM model. So that's only going to support the 16 LTE bands, and you're still going to have to go through T-Mobile to then get a factory unlock on that device. I don't think it comes carrier unlocked out of the box. Since you're buying it outright and you don't have a contract with T-Mobile, you're not required to have a contract with T-Mobile, I think you should be able to just have them unlock it, but that's a process that takes a couple days and could be a hassle. So I think, Colin, the only thing that you're left with is there are some services out there online that will claim to unlock iPhones on contract or not, and I've actually had a listener email me to tell me he's used one of the services. It did work for him. You did have to pay extra for the service. It's around $100. And it's one that's run by a pretty famous jailbreak hacker who goes by the handle Chronic. So you can go search for that. It is a hack. I don't think it's not officially supported. I don't know how carriers would react if you had a problem with your phone and you took it to the carrier. And I don't know if it looks like a legitimate unlock. You can look at the details on the website. You are going through some third party who's not associated with your carrier or Apple. So I'm even a little bit leery to recommend that anybody does that, but since that seems to be your only option, the other option Colin mentioned, and I don't know enough about this, but maybe the community, you know, you and the community can kind of kick back an email and let us know, is there an option to buy it in another country? Can you buy the 1586, 1524 models with the full 20 LTE bands in some other country fully unlocked? Maybe it's the kind of thing, Colin, you can get in China completely unlocked. I would imagine they would sell that model in that region, but obviously I think you're hoping to get it early, and it's sounding like China's not going to have them on sale until in 2015, so you'd be waiting a while on that. But maybe Australia, over in Europe, something like that, maybe you can get a model from one of those countries that's fully unlocked, and I think that's probably a possibility and maybe the best way to go. I don't know how that works with exchange rates and all those sorts of things, but definitely confusing. And, you know, when Apple comes out with a marketing thing, just says, we support 20 LTE bands, and you think, oh, good, we're good to go. What's even odder to me is because that 1586 model supports all the same CDMA, GSM, LTE bands as the other model, why wouldn't they just have one phone? I don't understand why there is still two different model phones, why we don't have one world phone. And that's the most confusing thing to me and something that I would really like to know the answer to. Next thing I have for you is a tip or just kind of a bit of information about the camera roll or the lack of the camera roll after upgrading to iOS 8. We've lived with the camera roll for so long, right? When you go in and you use the camera app on your iPhone, you take a picture, goes into the camera roll, or maybe it even goes into your photo stream. Both those things you're going to notice when you're using the camera app in iOS 8 are now gone. Don't panic, though. All your stuff is still there. It's just that Apple rejiggered some things and kind of changed how all of that stuff works. So basically, now all of the images that you take live inside the Photos app, not inside the camera app. There is no camera roll, which always seemed a little bit odd anyway, right? Because it's a digital thing. The camera roll kind of harkens back to the days of film. This is digital. We don't have film. And it kind of separated your photos between two apps. Now, snap a picture with the camera, it will go right into the Photos app. And where you're going to find most of your photos that you've taken is in a new album. So if you go into the albums area in the Photos app, there's some default albums, and there's one called Recently Added. So everything that you take will be in the Recently Added area. It will also be just in your photos. So if you go, you'll find them there sorted in the way that Apple sorts them under collections and years and moments and things like that. But you also have the Recently Added, which also basically effectively acts as your photo stream as well. It's kind of the photo stream and camera roll. I kind of picture it all rolled into one. And your stuff will stay in there. It looks like the last 1,000 photos in 30 days. It's not really clear. There's also some other default albums there just to kind of help better organize things. So you have a video album, a slow-mo album for your slow-mo videos, a bursts album for all the burst photos you take, faces, and then, of course, any custom albums that you might have set up inside the Photos application. And then within the Photos tab, you have all of your photo section with moments and collections, years, locations, and things like that. And Apple is keeping streams around, so there's a shared streams section, and that's where all of your shared photo streams that you've done are going to show up inside the photo apps, inside the photo app. So photos are now generally stored in the photos section, and that's where you're going to find them. And what's nice is they've added some new search features to help better group items as you're doing searching within the main photo library, because that can get overwhelming. And now when you search by month, say August, it's going to show all of your photos that were shot in August from all months, which is really neat because regardless of the year, you can kind of scroll back and see everything that you have from August. So it's great if you take a vacation around the same time every year, you can kind of find that. You can also do that by searching the location, or just if you're in that area, there's a new nearby option. So it will show you all the photos that you shot near that area. And as far as if you want to narrow your month search down to a specific year, just add the year to your search and you'll see just the photos in your photos from that specific year. So I think it's a little bit, makes a little bit more sense. It's a little bit jarring at first, which is why I wanted to point it out on the episode. But I think you'll eventually sort of get used to it. And the other thing that plays into this is something that's not released yet. It's the iCloud library. It's actually in iOS 8. At least for most people, I've heard some reports that some people don't see it, but you have iCloud Library, which is in beta. If you go into Settings, Photos, and Camera, You should see an iCloud Photo Library beta option. Now, it's turned off by default because there's some things that you want to be aware of before you turn it on. Enabling it will actually put all of your photos that are in the photo app up into iCloud. So not just the past 1,000 or 30 days, like with your photo stream, everything that you see on your iOS device that's in the Photos app is going to be put into PhotoStream. When you do that, it also is going to warn you that if you've synced photos from iTunes, which is how I do it on my iPhoto, on my iPhone, I just sync everything back through iTunes that I want to have on there, all of those photos are going to be removed. So you're going to want to make sure you do any kind of backups before you enable it. Of course, if you're syncing from iTunes, all of those photos should already be on your computer, but an extra backup actually never hurts. So once you've enabled it, everything's going to go into the iCloud Photo Library. Now, the thing about it is that, again, it's in beta and it's early. You'll be able to access them all from your iOS devices that are running iOS 8, but there's no Mac equivalent for the iCloud Photo Library yet. I'm assuming it's going to be part of the new Photos app, which is coming out sometime, I think, next year. I'm not even sure it's coming out with OS X Yosemite. So it's not really clear if you enable iCloud Photo Library how you're going to get at your photos on your Mac. You may have to wait. So you may not want to move things over there just quite yet. To me, it feels very iTunes Match-like, but for photos. As a matter of fact, your photos will be uploaded and stored in iCloud and at full resolution. So even if you shoot RAW, whatever it might be, it's going to stay at full resolution when it's stored up in iCloud. But by default, you're going to get device-optimized versions on your device, so they're not taking up as much space, and you'll be able to browse through and do things with those. As a matter of fact, you can even edit those versions, device-optimized versions, and it will sync up any of the edits that you made to the full-sized copies that are stored in iCloud. If you'd prefer just to have the full-resolution images on your device, you can actually change that setting and opt to download and keep the originals. But just keep in mind, you're going to be eating up a lot more storage space because, again, it's going to be everything that's in the Photos app on your iOS device. Unlike PhotoStream, though, iCloud Photo Library will count against your iCloud storage, so you need to be aware of that as well. If you opt to use the feature, it's going to eat up more of that free store, that free 5 gigabytes that you have. You're probably going to need more of that stuff. But as I said earlier, good news is that pricing came down a little bit. So you should be able to probably afford a little bit more storage if you need it. Personally, I'm waiting to use the iCloud Photo Library just like I'm going to wait to use the iCloud Library for my documents because I just, you know, I want it to be integrated with everything that I use, my Mac included. So that's the route I'm going, but just something to think about. The other thing that I'll mention real quickly is that if you've been using iPhoto with iOS 8, you're going to find that iPhoto no longer works in iOS 8. It's gone. Apple has announced that photos on iOS and photos on the Mac is going to be the new way we're going to manage our photos. So it's dead. It's gone. Apple said they were going to kill it. They followed through on that commitment. So when you launch iPhoto on iOS 8, what it's going to do is give you an option to migrate your data from iPhoto into the Photos app. But you need to be aware that it's not a direct migration because if you've been working with things like photo books and web journals and slideshows inside iPhoto, the photos themselves are going to get migrated and converted into albums inside the photo app, but you're going to lose any of that kind of formatting, the text on your journals, all that stuff obviously is not part of the photo, so it's not going to be transferred. Any image adjustments you made to those photos and iPhotos are going to be retained, but you will lose tags, captions from iPhoto. Those aren't displayed. Well, I shouldn't say lose. They're actually not displayed in the Photos app, but you can actually use them to still search for those terms, and they will show up as keywords and title searches and things like that. So you will be able to still search that metadata. I'm assuming it's still part of the file, and you probably can get at it on the desktop when we get the Photos app on OS X, but for now, it's just going to be there. You're not going to be able to edit it, change it, add to it, those sorts of things. So that is a significant change, especially for those people who were really heavy iPhoto users on iOS. I didn't use iPhoto too much on iOS. It had some nice things. What you'll find, though, too, is a lot of the editing functionality or probably the more used parts of the editing functionality for iPhoto did make its way into the new Photos app. So there's some nice features there. I'm not sure that they have all of those filters that we used to have, though. I'm going to have to play around with it a little bit more to double check on that. But just some things that I wanted to point out with Photos and the camera app and camera roll and all that stuff on iOS 8. Another big thing that Apple had announced at that keynote was Apple Pay. And since that announcement, I have had a lot of questions about Apple Pay. And probably most specifically, you know, how will it work? And I got a little bit more of that information this week through a number of the articles that I was reading. I think most of this stuff came from iMore. Hopefully I'm getting that credit right, because I like to give credit where credit is due. And we now kind of know exactly how the whole system will work. And I thought I'd run down kind of the different types of technology and kind of compare it to and explain why it will likely be a little bit better, more secure than your credit cards or even other tap-to-pay systems that are out there. So first and foremost is we know they're using near-field communication technology. It's using NFC. And NFC is inherently a little bit more secure because it only works in really close proximity, generally about 10 centimeters or less, which really limits the opportunity for any hackers to kind of intercept that data during transmission. So that whole man-in-the-middle style attack that we're used to with Wi-Fi, that's really extremely minimized because they'd have to be right up on you and you probably kind of see them doing it, or maybe they could implant some sort of device, but it definitely mitigates that sort of thing. The thing about it is that inherently NFC doesn't have to be encrypted. It's not encrypted by default. There's nothing in the specification says it has to be encrypted. But just like other technologies, transmissions can and will definitely be encrypted with Apple Pay. I don't think we have to worry about Apple, you know, sending open data. But again, you're in such close proximity that threat is really, really mitigated. But unlike other tap-to-pay systems that only use NFC, Apple has another element to this that adds a lot more security, and that is Touch ID. The thing is that NFC chips by themselves are always in a readable state. So that means if somebody can get close enough to your NFC chip with some sort of reader, it's going to happily wake itself up and start sending whatever data or information it's supposed to send. It's just going to happily do its thing. So that kind of opens up the possibility for someone to have a scanner kind of get up near your wallet with your cards, with your NFC chips in them, and try and kind of scan those and read them. Again, hopefully the data that's being sent out is encrypted, and that makes the process a lot harder. But with Apple Pay and Touch ID, that sort of stops that, what I'm calling a drive-by NFC scan, because you have to further, you know, that's going to wake up the chip and say, oh, I want to send information. It's going to require you to hit Touch ID and authenticate yourself before it's actually going to send out any information. And to me, that's a lot like signing our cards today, and actually better than signing the cards, or better than even chip and PIN, you know, plugging in a PIN number. You're actually verifying with a biometric element to actually complete that transaction. Now, we know the watch is a little bit different. It's going to be a PIN, but that just rolls back to more like a chip and PIN sort of system. You're still having to enter an additional bit of information before the transaction happens. So that, again, will stop any kind of drive-by sort of transactions. And then another thing is that also after your transaction is complete with Apple Pay, you get a notification on your device that something was charged, a payment just happened. So that's a further sort of security check. So even if someone were somehow able to do a drive-by and bypass the Touch ID, you're going to get an alert and say, hey, somebody just charged your card. You're going to like, no, or charged your Apple Pay. No, no, they didn't, right? You'll get that extra little bit. And so that's why I think Apple's able to get past a limitation of some of the current tap-to-pay systems that have an amount limit. So typically between $25 to $50 US, and that's because most tap-to-pay systems don't require any kind of signature. So they want to limit the ability for someone to get a hold of your card, go into some place and just tap to pay and charge up a storm, right? You wouldn't want that to happen. With Touch ID, that allows retailers to get past that limit. So you should be able to use Touch ID to make almost any purchase. We don't know a lot of details. We haven't found out if there is some sort of purchase limit with Touch ID. Probably will be there, but I would imagine it's going to be a lot higher than most other tap-to-pay systems. And like I said, what about the Apple Watch without Touch ID? There's some additional, in addition to just the PIN code, there's some additional checks and balances in there. it requires a passcode when you first put it on. So what happens is it detects skin contact, and Apple Pay is disabled until you have the device on and you enter a passcode. And then it stays authorized until you remove the device and it loses that skin contact. So if you've taken it off somewhere and somebody comes along and steals your Apple Watch, they can't go out and make payments without entering a PIN number that only you're going to know. So it's going to protect you there. And then as far as when you actually make a payment, you actually touch it. You don't have Touch ID to scan, but what will happen is it will ask you to confirm the transaction on the watch, and then you do have to press the physical button on the side of the watch to actually confirm that you want to make the transaction. So again, this is going to avoid and protect for sort of those drive-by type charges. So there's a lot of convenience and security in here that I think puts it far and above some of the other devices out there. The other thing is that Apple is not only doing Apple Pay as just the watch and the touch system, there's also a new system for doing purchases in apps. So if you need to order physical products or goods through an app, say like the Target app, you're going to be able to pay for that with your Apple Pay account. And the way that works and why that becomes a little bit better is you're not going to have to fill out any address information. By default, it's going to use the card that's on file, your default card that's registered with Apple Pay and with your Apple ID, so it can get all the information it needs from there. It's not going to do anything with that information other than share it with a retailer so they can actually ship you your product. And I'm assuming you can override which account or card you want to use during checkout, but typically most of us, and also override the address information if need be, but most of us are shipping to our homes. We're using a default credit card that we always like to use. So it's going to make that whole checkout process within an app much more convenient and easier. And I fully expect to see a lot more apps offering physical delivery of products because of Apple Pay. So that should be really cool and interesting. And then a lot of people might be worried, well, now I'm storing all these credit cards and all this credit card data on my phone. How is Apple actually protecting that stuff? And the first time you set up Apple Pay, what it's going to do is it's going to ask you, do you want to use the card that's on file with your iTunes account? And you can say yes, and then that information or that card is stored in the passbook, in your passbook. But really, the card itself is not stored. You can also capture other cards and have them stored into passbook with the camera on your device. But what happens is it'll take that information, it'll take the card information and put that into the passbook, but it doesn't show any of that stuff on the image. It removes all that stuff. It doesn't store any of that information. You just have the card in there, and it's more just so that you can pick which card you want to use to pay. And even when you're adding a card, there's some additional checks and balances to make sure that you own the card. Now, this is a little less clear. We're not sure exactly how Apple's doing this, but what happens is when you go to add a card to Apple Pay, it's going to check with the card issuing bank to make sure that the card is owned by you. Historically, the way a lot of banks have done this is they do an authorization charge that goes onto your bill, and then you just go online, you look at your bill, you confirm the amount. So they might put, you know, $1.23 on there, whatever, some random amount, almost like a PIN number. And then once you've plugged that back into, say, the passbook Apple Pay process, then it'll know, okay, that's your card, you have physical possession of it, you know what's going on, you have access to that account, and it verifies that. I'm assuming there's some other process that Apple's using other than that that's going to be a little less inconvenient, but we really don't know at this point. But they have said it's going to confirm that you're the card owner. And then once it's verified, it does not store the card number or the security code. What it actually does is generate a device account number, so a specific account number for that device. It's unique for Apple Pay on that device. And then it stores that encrypted in something called the Secure Element, which is a dedicated chip for Apple Pay. We don't know exactly where that chip is. You know, is it on the motherboard? Is it part of one of the processors that's on there? But Apple has said it's in there. So it's, I think, sort of like the Secure Enclave that stores your Touch ID fingerprint in the M8 and M7 processor. So think similar to that. It's going to be this dedicated chip, encrypted, stored, and only on the device. So what happens then when you go to use Apple Pay is it uses that device account number to generate a one-time payment number and a transaction-specific security code. So it kind of puts together this little token. What they're calling it is the tokenization process that you may have heard of, and combines all that together, creates this token, and that's what's sent to the payment processor and then used back to match back to your account on the other end to actually make the charge and make the purchase. And because these things are one-time use, even if that token is intercepted, it would severely limit any fraud that could be done because it can only be used that one time for that one transaction, and then it's thrown out and invalidated. So never again are you storing credit card information in your card. There's no credit card data. None of that stuff is even transmitted. So man-in-the-middle type attacks, those sorts of things are going to be severely limited with Apple Pay. And again, these are all the reasons why I think it's going to be a little bit better than, well, a lot better than and more secure than credit cards that we have today, especially the swipe and sign cards we have here in the U.S., but also even better than chip and PIN, better than other tap-to-pay sorts of systems. And why Apple has, I think, a good chance with all the partnerships they've done of really getting Apple Pay to take off. And then there's a whole other factor. What happens if you lose your device, you lose your phone, everything goes missing, now they have your stuff? Well, got all these other blocks in place like Touch ID and all these other things. Add to that, you also have the ability to now use Find My iPhone to disable Apple Pay on your lost device. And this sounds like it's completely separate from actually having to disable the device or, you know, wipe it clean or anything like that. You can just say, you know what, lock out Apple Pay on that device. Don't allow it to be used anymore. It's been lost. And what's cool is, since you even need communications access to use Apple Pay, they can't just block out your ability to disable it by putting it into airplane mode. They're going to have it on and communicating to be able to do that, and thus you'll be able to get in there and lock it down, use Find My iPhone, all those sorts of things. So it's really going to just deter anybody from even wanting to try and take that kind of device, because they're not going to be able to do anything with it, really, between activation lock and the ability to completely lock out Apple Pay with all these checks and balances. It's really not worth it. So kind of the last thing in Apple Pay everybody was wondering about is, well, that's great and dandy, but how does Apple make any money in this deal? The Financial Times is claiming that Apple is going to keep a 0.0015% cut of every purchase made with Apple Pay. And that sounds like a really tiny amount, but it basically means that Apple is going to get 15 cents for every $100 spent using Apple Pay. And if this thing becomes as big as I think it's going to be, that's probably going to translate to billions of dollars to Apple's bottom line. Think globally how much is spent using credit cards. And granted, not every transaction is going to immediately move over to Apple Pay, but I have a feeling a good percentage, even just 1-2%, this could add up to big dollars for Apple. And I think that's what they're banking on. So that's, you know, my understanding of the complete Apple Pay system as it stands today. I'm sure we'll get more information and details as time progresses. And if you happen to know a little bit more, feel free to share it. Shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. And we're running really long on this episode, but I do have one more thing for you. A few shows back, we discussed the early 2011 MacBook Pro discrete GPU failure. This was a pretty serious flaw in the early 2011 models, where the dedicated GPU will just fail, and Apple has yet to acknowledge it. They're not issuing any kind of extended warranty replacement for it. What happens is affected units will get glitchy displays, non-functioning displays. And several listeners have said they've kind of had these issues. Listener Scott was one of those listeners, and he thought he had those symptoms. But it turned out, when he took the unit to an Apple-authorized repair center to get it diagnosed, they discovered that while it had similar symptoms, it was kind of displaying some of the issues that may look like a GPU failure. It turned out to be just that the system management controller needed to be reset. And so they did that reset, and all was well and good with his machine again. So I thought, you know, this, we should talk about this. We've actually covered it on the MacCast before as a general fix, but it's definitely worth revisiting now, since some of you might think you have a GPU failure, but really all you have to do is reset the system management controller and away you go. So the SMC, just so you know, can address a host of Mac-related issues, including your fans running out of control. So if your fans just have been running like crazy and you don't know why, fix that. Lights and backlights behaving oddly. So if you know, your backlight dimming is all weird, or your keyboard light backlighting is getting weird. If you're having general power or battery issues, if it's misreporting the battery life, or just if even if it's suddenly powering off, or you're having trouble waking from sleep, random shutdowns, slow system performance, if you're seeing beach balls, this can address a number of issues. Now, before you do an SMC reset, Apple generally recommends you do typical troubleshooting. So make sure you, one, reboot. You know, sometimes just rebooting your Mac can fix things. If that doesn't work, do the standard diagnostic stuff. Run disk utility, run repair permissions, try all that sort of stuff. Start up, you know, with the shift key held down, so you start in safe boot mode, just verifying that you don't have something weird running in the background that's causing your issues. But if you rule out all that stuff and you're still having these kinds of problems, you can reset your system management controller. And how you do that is different depending upon the model Mac you have, whether you have a portable or a desktop, whether you can remove the battery or not. There's actually an Apple support article. I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com so you can get all the details. But I thought I'd cover doing it with MacBooks that don't have a removable battery. I think that's most current MacBook models, and also how to do it with your desktop models. So for a MacBook without a removable battery, you basically shut down the Mac. You need to plug in the MagSafe power connector to a power source, connect it to your Mac if it's not already connected. And then on the built-in keyboard, make sure you don't do this on your Bluetooth keyboard. On the built-in keyboard, on the left side, press the Shift, Control, and Option keys along with the power button at the same time. And then release all of them and the power button at the same time. And then press the power button to turn your computer on. That will reset the system management controller. Something to be aware of is the LED on the MagSafe power adapter. Its state may change, and it might even turn off temporarily as you're doing the reset. So just be aware of that. That should reset the SMC, and hopefully your problems are resolved. If you have a desktop Mac, a Mac Pro, an Intel-based iMac, Intel-based Mac Mini, or an Intel-based Xserve, it's a little bit different. You shut down the computer, then you unplug the power cord, wait 15 seconds, then reattach the power cord, wait 5 more seconds, and then press the power button to turn on the computer, and that should reset the SMC. So hopefully that will solve a trip to the Genius Bar or to your Apple authorized reseller, and you can sort of fix the machine yourself. If all of that doesn't work and you have one of the early 2011 models and is experiencing those sort of GPU-ish related issues, then you probably do want to make a Genius Bar appointment and get it into your local Apple authorized reseller. But Scott, I certainly appreciate you sharing your story with us, and a great tip to bring up. You know, resetting the SMC can fix a lot of things. But with that, I think that is going to do it for this extra-sized 500th episode of the MacCast. Thanks for listening. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Smile, makers of Text Expander, Disc Label, PDF Pen, also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices. Now in iOS 8, you can get Text Expander Keyboard, which makes using Text Expander on iOS devices even better. So check that out. Also, PDF Pen for your iOS devices and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of that over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, hey, if you need some cash for that new iPhone 6 purchase, Gazelle is a great place to go. It's the fast and simple way to sell your used gadget. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, and other Apple products are worth over at gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free trial by going to lynda.com/MacCast. That's lynda.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. I'd also like to thank CashFly. They provide the bandwidth for the MacCast. You can find them at cashfly.com, CACHEFLY.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. Find them at backbeatmedia.com. Thank you for listening. Thanks for staying subscribed. If you have a comment for me, a question, a topic you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me feedback. My email address is maccast@gmail.com. You can also leave a voicemail on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's over at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. If you'd like to find me online, you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can also check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And don't forget, we do have a Google Plus community. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus and you will find us there. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, and with a brand new iPhone 6 Plus in hand, I will talk to you all again real soon.